Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we'll be learning about The Secret World of Wasps with Sirian Sumner, who's going to share her book, Endless Forms, with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I am so glad you're here and we get to talk about wasps. It's not a topic I thought I would get to cover on this channel. So I'm really excited that there is an expert on wasps and you're going to tell us why we should think about them differently. But before we dive into that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Yeah, so I am a professor of behavioral ecology at University College London. And I guess I come from a background of zoology and interest in animal behavior, and have also kind of integrated molecular methods to try and understand the sort of the welly boot biology, the work, the studying the behavior of these different insects in the field. So my research combines a kind of field ecology with molecular analyses. And I've always studied social, well, since my research career started, I've always studied social insects. And I began studying wasps for my PhD. And I've dabbled a little bit in ants and bees and even termites, but wasps remain the mainstay of my research. And so I've sort of inadvertently become rather obsessed with wasps, and that's why I've written this book.
That's a wonderful reason to write the book. Could you take us back to when you were getting ready to enter college? Did you have a feeling you would end up studying insects? What did you think that you would do?
Yeah, not at all. I have to confess, I mean, I was always interested in animal behavior and I wanted to study behavior, but I was very much more into bird watching and the cute furry mammals, and certainly not insects. In fact, I was definitely one of those wasp swatters. I wasn't into insects. I wasn't sort of an entomologist. I would actively shy away from anything that was a creepy crawly. So the fact I ended up, so my undergraduate degree was in zoology, and all the way through my zoology degree I would be interested in the vertebrates rather than the invertebrates, but then this PhD position came my way and it was on behavior, social behavior. It just so happened that the animals that were behaving were wasps, so I kind of accidentally grew to love insects.
In the book, you tell us that there are not that many scientists even who study wasps, and that Darwin himself struggled to find a purpose for wasps. When you were doing your PhD, how did you find mentors and research funds so you could undertake your study?
That's a really good question. So I guess the point is that a lot of the research funding, and this goes for PhDs and also for, you know, for bigger grants, it's to do with the questions rather than the organism. And the fact that it was wasps didn't really matter. The PhD was about studying and trying to understand the evolution of sociality and why individuals would choose to live in a group rather than live alone, and the evolution of altruism. And it just so happened that wasps, these hover wasps that lived in Malaysia, happened to be a very good model for testing those questions. So at the time, I didn't realise, when I started working on wasps in my PhD, I didn't realise actually that wasps were the kind of the underdog of the insect world, because I saw at the time, I didn't think of them any differently to how I saw bees and ants. In terms of mentors, I mean, again, I wasn't specifically looking for any wasp gurus or wasp mentors at the time. But there were some names that did immediately jump out to me when I started my PhD. So that's what I like to call her, the wasp legend, really. Mary Jane West Eberhard, who's an American scientist who published some really influential papers in the 1960s about wasp social behaviour. And I would say that she has been instrumental in putting wasps in the kind of research limelight and taking them beyond just natural history to being a really, you know, an important model organism for studying social evolution. So I guess she was kind of my sort of guru that I saw, you know, from afar. I didn't actually meet her until after my PhD, and I ended up being able to work with her a little bit at the Smithsonian Institute in Panama as part of my fellowship many years later. But there weren't that many wasp researchers around, but it didn't matter to me at the time. I think the realisation that there is a paucity of researchers studying wasps didn't actually dawn on me until quite recently, actually, when I started to sort of dig into more of the ecological questions that wasps could help answer. And I realised that there was a almost complete absence of literature on the roles of wasps in ecology and ecosystems. And then I started to look at, hang on a minute, all these conferences, these social insect conferences that I've been going to for 20 odd years. Let's have a look and see whether people genuinely don't like to study wasps. And lo and behold, you know, the number of insect conference talks on bees and ants would far outnumber those on wasps. In fact, I've just returned from a social insect conference in San Diego. I'm horribly jet lagged at the moment. And at that conference, 50% of talks were on ants, I think, and 35% on bees. It might be the other way around, I can't quite remember. But there were only 8% of talks were on wasps. And so even now, 20 years on, there is still a reluctance, maybe not a reluctance, or it's maybe just lack of opportunity, lack of funding for people to be studying wasps, which I think is an enormous oversight. And I'm hoping that my book might encourage more people to think more fondly about wasps and see the whole diversity of the science and ecology that these insects can help us study.
I'm somewhat of a book nerd, and I know that to have a book get shepherded through the publishing process and end up in readers' hands, you have to write a proposal. You have to get someone to say, oh yes, people will buy this, people will read this. And you let us know several places in the book that people are very excited to care about bees and learn more about bees. How did you get all the gatekeepers to say, oh yeah, people will care about wasps, let's publish a mainstream book on wasps?
That's a really good question. I never thought that anyone would want to publish a book on wasps. I guess the way it's happened, it's been a bit of a, I never intended to write this book. It's been something that has evolved to the point where I knew I had to write it. And the way it happened was that as I got through my career, you know, the first 10 years or so, most of my career actually working on wasps, I've been studying social evolution and sort of very evolutionary kind of high level questions, which I think members of the public struggle to relate to. And I got a bit fed up with people, you know, they could be people I meet at a party or just, you know, parents of our children's friends or, you know, whatever. And they say, well, why are you studying wasps? What's the point of wasps? And I'd end up saying, well, you know, wasps are really interesting. They have these really cool social behaviors. And they just weren't that interested in that. They were like, oh, they just looked really nonplussed. And then I started to give more talks, like to village halls of like women's institutes gatherings or local natural history societies. And I would through this talk, I would basically start to try and pitch why people should care about wasps. And that sort of led me to think more about the role of wasps in the environment, because ultimately we value the facets of nature that we can see a direct benefit from. So we love bees, we benefit from bees because of their pollination. And in the case of the honeybee, we benefit from the food that they provide us with, the honey and the wax. But wasps, you know, what do wasps provide us with? And I started to look into it. And of course, I knew that wasps were hunters. It's just a basic part of their biology. But I was amazed at the absence of any substantial amount of literature on what wasps eat and what the impact they have on the environment is. And you know, the million-dollar question is, what would the world without wasps look like? And there's this very famous quote, which may or may not have been Einstein, that if bees disappeared from the planet, then humans would only have 4 years left to live. And that is often bandied around. And I think, you know, we could ask the same question of any organism, but I would like to put it out there that if wasps disappeared from the planet, how long would humans have to live? And I think that then makes people wake up and think about it. And so by doing that, by giving these talks, it sort of, these are sort of layman talks, you know, to the public, it sort of took me down this new route of research, thinking about the role of wasps in the environment and ecosystems. And I realized that there was so little there that I started to do some research on it. And then suddenly I had I noticed the reaction in the crowds when I was giving these talks, that when I talked about the soap operas of wasp societies and how amazing they are, a few people would nod their heads and there'd be a small smile. But when I talked about the importance of wasps and why wasps were nature's pest controllers, and that in a world without wasps, we'd have to use many more pesticides and chemicals to kill the other insects that wasps eat and remove from the environment, like flies and aphids and caterpillars that are pests to us, then I could see people starting to sit up and take notice. And then I realized the light switched on. I thought, okay, this is what people need to understand. They need to appreciate that wasps are doing a really important role in the ecosystem. And once people realized that, I found it was actually remarkably easy to persuade them that actually they should be giving wasps a bit more kudos and a bit more appreciation than they currently do. And so by giving these talks over a period of a few years, really, I realized that I couldn't change people's perceptions one village hall at a time, and that I had started doing a little bit of popular science writing as well, with articles in a few books and on newspapers. And I really enjoyed writing in that way for a lay audience. And I just thought, okay, I need to actually write this book, because I can't just be this sort of one woman show going around village halls in England telling people to love wasps and why they should love wasps. So that's kind of how the original, pitching to myself, right? That's the first step when you want to write a book. You've got to pitch to yourself. You've got to be convinced that you've got that book in you. And so, you know, this is 2.5 years ago now, I guess, I realized that I had this book in me, and I almost felt like it was spilling out of me, because I'd already been giving these talks and I knew exactly what I wanted to go in the book, or so I thought. So then I ended up writing a proposal, and some friends introduced me to my agent, Will Francis, who was very encouraging. I was surprised that he was encouraging. But I think one of the other things that really helped persuade him and the publishers who ultimately published the book was that I would say, you know, you walk into any bookshop and you are inundated. You're tripping over books about bees. And they could be books written by bee scientists or by journalists or by naturalists or nature writers. There is a book about bees to satisfy any kind of customer. And there's children's books about bees. And, you know, there's whatever book you're interested in, there is a book about bees for you. And yet there are no books about wasps. There are no popular science books that kind of bring the science of wasps, the natural history of wasps, to people. There are a few sort of encyclopedic type books, but there are no books that kind of try and tell the story about wasps in the same way that has been done for bees. So there was a niche in the market, and I had my personal drive and my personal pitch ready. And it kind of just snowballed from there. I think my agent was very good at selling my proposal.
You tell us in the book that you were somewhat interested in insects when you were very little. You take us back to when you were 3 years old and you were playing in the garden in Wales. Your interest was not wasps in particular, but you were interested in being on the ground and seeing the creepy crawlies. Can you tell us about 3-year-old you in the garden in Wales?
Yeah, I start my book with this story that, of course, I don't remember it because I was three, but my mum constantly reminds me of this story. I think it's very much embedded in her memory of me. When I first was three, born, and I until about the age of 3 or 4, I lived in this very tiny little village in the middle of West Wales. Very, very tiny. And the back garden was very wet. It's Wales. You know, Wales is a very wet country. But lots of, you know, in the countryside, lots of nature all around me. And I would always be out there in my welly boots, just sort of stomping around the garden. And I apparently picked up a slug and put it in my mouth, and I was a very greedy child. I was quite fat, you know, I like my food. And my mum found me with this mouth full of this kind of gooey mess, and she had to clean it out. And I think she possibly still hasn't recovered from that moment. Hence the story that I have grown up hearing all the time about the time I ate the slug. And so I start the book with that, but when you write a book, I think what I've learned now, at least with just writing this book, is that you don't start at the beginning. And so I wrote the beginning at the very end. And it just seems so apt to talk about this slug, because I think slugs are as maligned as wasps are in the invertebrate world. People hate slugs, probably almost as much as they hate wasps. And I started off my small life by eating a slug. And then my mum's reaction was, you know, she was horrified that I would eat this slug. And obviously it was a big ordeal getting it out of my mouth. And I, you know, she definitely from then onwards, I think she was probably a bit worried about what else I might put in my mouth from the garden. And I think that maybe is the root of, don't tell my mum, but I think it might be the root of why I wasn't really into invertebrates as a child. Although I had this passion for nature, I didn't really take any interest in the creepy crawlies. And possibly it was that my mum was always telling me to keep away from things like that once after the slug incident. But you know, I think it was a nice way to start the book though, because it brings it home about, you know, we're so influenced by our culture, by our upbringing. It's not my mum's fault, this, that she possibly made me very invertebrate averse. It's that, you know, we teach our children to avoid things that we think might harm them. And she clearly thought that, you know, eating slugs was not going to be good for me. but I think we teach our children to fear wasps. You know, if you're sitting having a picnic or, you know, eating outside and a wasp comes along, if you observe a family, they'll quickly be swatting it away and they're terrified their child's going to get stung. And children pick up on those cues. So I think we learn from a very early age that wasps are bad. Wasps are to be feared. Wasps are going to sting you. They're really bad things. Whereas bees are cute. You know, they might sting you, but they're probably not going to. They're more interested in flowers. And you learn that from a young age. And I think that is partly why I think partly it's that's the explanation for why there's been so little research into wasps, because as well as you know, the direction of science is obviously influenced by funding a lot and trends, but it's also influenced by culture. And I think if we are growing up learning to dislike undervalue something, see something as having no value, then we are less inclined to be drawn into that as a research field as well.
In the introduction, you mentioned when you were working on your PhD, you write that you were lying flat on the jungle floor of a Malaysian rainforest with a wasp dangling above my nose. And I wrote next to that, please say more. So will you?
Yeah, that was a bit of a wake up. So I started this PhD in UCL, University College London. And as I said, I was interested in the behaviour and I kind of blanked out the fact that they were wasps. And actually, I can't remember whether it's in the book or not, but basically I was tricked into doing this PhD in wasps by my PhD supervisor, Jeremy Field. Because I remember very clearly when he was interviewing me for the position, I said, oh, it sounds really interesting, but, you know, I don't really like wasps. I don't want to get stung. And he said, oh, don't worry. No, they don't really sting. No, these wasps don't sting. Which, of course, is a complete lie. And if I'd known anything about hunting wasps, I would have known that he was lying to me. But they do sting. Of course they sting. All wasps, all hunting wasps sting. And so I found myself, so the project was actually a molecular project looking at the, using molecular markers to estimate the relatedness of brood in these social wasp nests and work out who's laying the eggs and work out how these reproductive conflicts over who lays the eggs are resolved. And so a lot of my project was molecular. And I had to sort of beg him to take me to the field because in Malaysia, I really wanted to go and see these organisms in action. And he told me they didn't sting, so nothing to worry about. So I managed to persuade him that I should come to the field in my first year of my PhD, whereas actually it was only scheduled for the second year. And so I was like, I knew I had to impress. I knew I had to sort of be super enthusiastic. And luckily, I absolutely loved doing the field work. And that I remember that very first day, there was Jeremy, myself, and the postdoc who was on a grant with Jeremy, Gavin Shreves. And it was a bit of a pressure that I had to sort of join in. And Gavin had already been lying on the jungle floor with a wasp nest in his face, so I just did the same, and I was lying on the floor and I thought, okay, that's okay, because these wasps are actually these hover wasps are quite gentle. They're very small societies. They're little open nests, so they sit on their nest, you can see them. They're about less than a centimeter long. They do sting, but they really only have very weak stings. And so their stings will only really penetrate your skin if it's a very sensitive part. So like on, you know, your wrist or your neck or something down, it won't sting you if it just wipes against you on your arm. And they certainly don't come at you. They don't fly at you. In fact, their main form of defense against predators is to simply drop off the nest. So if you frighten these wasps, they all just literally drop like dead flies off the nest and fly away. They're really hopeless. So in terms of a wasp, they are rather pathetic. And as an entry, as an entree to studying social wasps, they are the perfect way to start. So it wasn't, I mean, the fact that I was lying on the jungle floor with this wasp nest dangling above my nose might sound really horrific to somebody, but actually it wasn't. They were very gentle wasps and they weren't, you know, as long as I didn't move jerkily, they weren't going to fall on top of me. But they were literally a few centimetres above my nose. I have a very strong recollection just lying on this jungle floor, which of course there's lots of other insects as well in the litter leaf. So I'm getting lots of insect bites, which I previously would never have tolerated. But I was lying on the jungle floor, sort of feeling like I'm going to do this. I can do this. And it was when I realised that, you know, we would paint the wasps individually, so we knew the identities of each of the wasps, we knew their age, and we knew their kind of role in the society. It was very much like a soap opera. I describe this a lot in the book about the soap opera, the interactions of these individuals on the nest. And I just got totally swept away with the drama of these wasps. And I was personally attached to, you know, individuals. It was ridiculous. Yeah, so I luckily, my determination to make the most of it resulted in me falling in love with them. So yeah, it was fine.
I have to ask though, how did your mom handle the news that you were going to go do this?
I don't think she minded at all, as long as it wasn't her. I think she quite enjoyed telling people that her daughter was, she didn't call it the reproductive conflicts in wasps. She called it the sex life of wasps, because that was much more shocking to her friends. I think she just thought it was great. She, you know, she's always been one for an adventure. And she was just pleased that I was doing something that I found that I enjoyed, I think. So, yeah, she didn't mention the slug thing again. I think she was a bit shocked when she read my book and she realised that I brought up the slug. I started the book with the slug story.
You talk in the book about how the more you learn about wasps, the more curious you get, that you have so many questions about why there are so many species of wasps and why they are so diverse in form and function. And you list long categories of jobs that wasps have, including farmers, but I would like to add to your list mad scientists. Can you tell us about the wasps that inject the caterpillars with the venom and the virus at the same time?
Oh yeah, everybody likes to hear about that one. Yeah, so these are these are actually parasitoid wasps. So these are not stinging wasps. And so the parasitoid wasps, in fact, let's just backtrack a bit. So there are about 100,000 species of wasps, and there are probably 10 times more that just haven't been described yet. So that's why we call the book Endless Forms, because there are probably more species of wasps than any other insect or possibly animal group on our planet. But about 70 to 80% of those wasps are non-stinging. And these include the parasitoids, which don't have a sting. They have an ovipositor, which they use to lay an egg in a host, which is often a caterpillar or a beetle larva or a fly larva. And their ovipositor is often very long and dramatic looking. So if you've seen an insect flying with a very long, thin, what might look like a sting hanging out of its bottom, that is an ovipositor. It's not a sting. And they use that, they inject that into the host and lay their egg, and then they disappear. And the egg will hatch into a larva, and then it will end up eating the caterpillar alive. But the mother wasp never goes back. She's basically, there's no parental care at all. But along with the egg down the ovipositor, the parasitoid wasp will also inject a cocktail of venom, and some of that venom will suppress the immune system of the caterpillar to ensure that it doesn't attack the growing baby wasp. And it's also in some species of wasps, they have this a very special relationship with a virus that they inject along with the egg and the venom into the host caterpillar. And this virus helps suppress the host immune system, which of course boosts the chances of the wasp larva developing and surviving. And so it's an intimate relationship between the wasp and the virus. So they've mingled their genomes to make this unique type of virus. But as well as preventing the caterpillar's immune system from attacking the larva, the virus also alters the composition of the caterpillar's saliva, which suppresses the plant's immune system and allows the caterpillar to grow faster, and that makes the caterpillar much more of a juicier meal for the baby wasp. So it's really amazing symbiosis. But there is a sting in the tail here, because the virus also sends signals to another type of wasp, another parasitoid wasp, which is attracted in, and it then lays its eggs on the parasitoid wasp's egg, on the first wasp's eggs. And that's called a hyperparasitoid. It's a parasite of a parasite. So you've got this caterpillar feeding on the plant, and you've got the first parasitoid wasp feeding on the caterpillar, and then you've got this second parasitoid wasp feeding on the caterpillar and the first parasitoid wasp. So it's an amazing, the really exciting thing is that it's the virus that the first parasitoid wasp has this beautiful symbiosis with, this mutualism, but actually the virus is getting one back on the parasitoid by drawing in some other parasitoid wasp. And you couldn't make it up, could you? You really couldn't make that up. Evolution is really incredible.
I think that's why people like this story. You said it's a popular one to be asked about. It's got so many components to it that it's better than science fiction. You mentioned in the book that wasps are often featured in scary movies or science fiction movies, but the book kind of lets us know we don't need a fiction version of wasps.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, there was being a sort of a wasp, you know, if a writer or an artist or, you know, anyone or a journalist wants to find a wasp expert, they just Google it. And often if they're in Britain, my name will pop up. And I had a fiction writer contact me a few years ago who wanted to, and I remember him, he called me up. He said, "Are you sitting down? Because this is going to be the strangest conversation you've ever had." And I thought, this is a bit odd. And he said, "No, I'm writing this thriller, and I want I've got this murder victim, and I want their eyes to be bulging with baby wasps, and then I want the wasps to burst out of the eyes, the victim's eyes." And he said, is that possible? Can it actually happen? He said, "I know it's a bit far-fetched." I said, "Well, actually, that's kind of what a parasitic wasp does, a hunting, you know, parasitoid or a parasitic or a hunting solitary wasp does exactly that. They would lay, I mean, not normally a human eye, to be fair. There's a bit of artistic license there. But the most of the, so along with the parasitoid wasps, which lay their eggs in prey, in hosts, the solitary hunting wasps, so not the ones that live in societies, but the ones that live on their own, which is about 30,000 species, they lay their egg, they will hunt some prey, so like a caterpillar or a spider, and they'll bring it to their burrow and they'll paralyze it. And it will, unlike, as with the parasitoid wasps, will keep them, won't paralyze their prey. But these hunting wasps who have a sting, not an ovipositor, they've modified, evolution has modified the ovipositor to be a sting. These solitary hunting wasps have a venom cocktail that includes neurotoxins, which will paralyze the prey. And it also has lots of antiviral properties and antifungal properties. So it keeps the antibacterial properties. So it keeps the prey as a kind of suspended living larder, which is alive, but incapable of doing anything. And then they lay their egg on or in that. And then in the same way as the parasitoid wasp larva, these hunting wasp larvae will hatch and eat their living prey, paralyzed prey, alive from the inside out. So this is a running theme. As you can see, how that sort of story of eating the living till they're dead is kind of perfect fodder for a science fiction or a thriller novel.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
And you say in the book that wasps have been depicted by the gangsters of the as the gangsters of the insect world and as winged thugs. Some parts of your book seem to support that, but there's many things that wasps do. And one is their interaction with oak trees in creating the oak galls. Where I live, we have live oak trees that are protected, and the galls will sometimes, they'll fall off the tree, we'll find them on the ground. Can you tell us about the role of wasps in creating those oak galls?
Yeah, it's interesting because not so much is known about those. It's an example of how wasps can manipulate plants. So the gall wasps will lay their eggs on the underside of a leaf or a stem, and that will induce, and then they'll leave them, and that will induce the plant to grow this hard gall around the egg, and then the egg just develops into a larva, and it feeds off the plant within its gall, and so the plant is providing the baby wasp with nutrition, but it's also providing it with a protective casing around it. So it's effectively taking over the parental care on behalf of the wasp. And it's really, you know, they're so common, but actually, astonishingly, we don't really understand how it happens and what the mechanisms are by which the wasp manages to manipulate the plant in this way.
And you give us examples in the book as well about how plants are also manipulating wasps. Can you talk a bit about how orchids do this?
Oh, yeah. The orchids' story is just very beautiful. I really enjoyed writing about this. So there are orchids which mimic a female wasp. And so they look like a female wasp. They smell like a female wasp. They feel like a female wasp, and they even taste like a female wasp. And so male wasps can't resist them at all. And they'll come along to these orchids and they'll try and mate with them, and they mate quite vigorously. And by doing that, the plant will dab a dollop of pollen onto the back of the male wasp. And then, of course, in being a typical male, once he's done, or so he thinks he's done, he moves on to the next flower, and therefore he takes pollen from flower to flower. And it's incredible. It's just huge. I just love this sort of image of these males just helplessly swooning from flower to flower. Oh my goodness, there's so many lovely, sexy females around, and they're just completely deceived by the plants. It's a fantastic story. I really enjoyed reading about that.
When we think of pollinators, the general public, we do think of bees and butterflies, and you want us to start thinking of wasps as pollinators as well. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the obvious, you know, if somebody wants to know what do wasps do in the environment, the obvious is that they're hunters and pest controllers. And that is, you know, I wouldn't say it's well studied, but it's well acknowledged. But their role as pollinators is a little less well acknowledged. And you know, there are some well studied examples, like the pollen, the male wasps that pollinate the orchids, and those orchids depend entirely on that species of wasp for pollination. So that's a very highly evolved manipulation relationship between the plant and the wasp. But there are also some other types of wasps which are where they are really important pollinators. And in fact, there's a whole group of wasps called the pollen wasps, the Massarinae, which are entirely vegetarian. They're like, they've done, you know, evolution has done with those wasps what it has done with bees. So bees evolved from what? From a wasp ancestor. And so bees are, I like to say, bees are basically wasps that have forgotten how to hunt prey. And instead they hunt, inverted commas, pollen to feed to their brood, and they rear their brood on pollen rather than pollen and nectar rather than insect protein. And there is this group of wasps, which actually isn't so small, there's quite a few of them, pollen wasps, which are entirely dependent on collecting pollen to feed to their offspring. And they're an example of a group that is very understudied. In fact, I really struggled to find out much about them when I was writing about them in my book, because it's not something I'd read about before. There's a husband and wife team in South Africa, the Guesses, who have done pretty much the only work on these pollen wasps. And it was thought that pollen wasps were only limited to a peculiar tiny bit of South Africa, because that's where they live. But actually, it turns out that they're actually quite cosmopolitan. You have them in the States, for example, you have them in Europe. It's just that no one has really studied them. But the Guesses work has shown that these wasps are likely to be very effective pollinators. They do visit the flowers. They are very faithful to particular types of flowers. And in fact, oddly, they seem to lose some of their body parts as well by visiting the flowers, which no one really understands why. But the ultimate experiment, which would maybe give us some even more reason to value these wasps, would be to look at their pollination effectiveness. So we know about how effective different types of bees are in pollen transfer. These groups of wasps, the pollen wasps, we kind of really need to do that experiment to find out how effective they are. They must be pretty effective, given that they seem to be quite faithful to their types of wasps, of plants that they pollinate. But it's an astonishingly understudied area. So if there's anyone looking for a research area to dive into that's not very densely populated at the moment, it's certainly the pollen wasps. But in terms of most other wasps, of course, there is the fig wasps, which is another prime example of wasp pollination. In fact, that's probably the most famous example of wasps as pollinators. And it's a standard textbook co-evolution story. There's about 800 species of fig wasps they are largely, but not completely, faithful to particular species of fig. So particular species of fig wasp will pollinate a particular species of fig. And it's a completely, their life cycles are completely dependent. They're completely mutualistically dependent on each other. So the way this works is the fig wasp will, the fig wasp females, because it's only the females that ever leave the fruit, they will dive into a fig, covered with pollen from their previous fig, the nursery that they grew up in. They will lay their eggs around the fig itself, inside the fruit. And as they do, they spread pollen from their nursery fig. And there we go, they're doing the pollination bit there. And then there's some fun bits that go on as well after that. So the eggs hatch, and it's the males that hatch first. And they are the brothers of the females, and when the females hatch, the males pounce on them and mate. It's total incest. It's quite horrendous. And then the males will drill a hole out of the fruit, making their little, you know, pathway for their mated sisters to depart by. So those newly mated females will romp around the fruit, covering themselves in pollen, and then they'll exit the fruit and go on to the next fruit, and therefore carry on their pollination. And that is the fact that there's 800 over 800 species of fig fig wasp co-evolved species that depend on each other is, I think, it's testament to how successful that story of co-evolution has happened. So there's the fig wasps, there's the pollen wasps, and there's the orchid wasps. But apart from those three, the idea that wasps are pollinators is largely understudied. But actually, in a review we wrote last year, we published it in Biological Reviews with some colleagues of mine, we went through the literature looking for evidence of wasps on flowers. Now, this is not, I'm not going to say that this is definitely pollination, because you need an experiment to show they're actually effectively transferring pollen. But the fact that a wasp is on a flower will mean that they may be acquiring pollen on their bodies and carrying it to another flower, and therefore pollinating. And so just to also backtrack a bit, so why should these other wasps that don't have this co-evolution or deception by plants visit flowers in the first place? And the reason for this is very simple if you think about their life cycle. So let's take a social wasp like your Vespula, your common yellow jacket wasp, for example. The workers will go out hunting, they'll catch prey, they'll bring it back to the nest, and they feed the larvae, which are their siblings, with this light, which this prey that they've chewed up. But the adults themselves don't actually eat that protein. Those adults are largely vegetarians. And so they have to visit flowers to get sugar, to get carbohydrates in order to sustain themselves. So that's their main source of nutrition. And the same is the case for the solitary hunting wasps and also for the parasitoid wasps, that they, although they interact with proteinaceous prey, they don't actually eat them at all. And although some of the hunting wasps might suck a cheeky bit of hemolymph from a spider when they paralyze it, but they're vegetarian, so they have to visit flowers. So all these wasps are visiting flowers. And what we found in our review is that these wasps are visiting any old flower. They seem to be rather generalists. I think we counted up to over 850 species of plants appeared to be visited by wasps across over 100 different families. And the diversity was huge. I mean, I'm no botanist, but it was just a huge diversity. They pollinate, they visit these flowers from whatever flowers seem to be around. Some authors who've studied this have suggested that because these wasps appear to be generalist in their choice of what flowers they visit, perhaps they're really important in ecosystems for pollination. Now, many bees tend to be very specific about the types of flowers that they visit, and it will often depend on the length of their tongue as to what kind of flower they can access. But wasps don't do that. They're not fussy. They will visit any flower, it seems. And so perhaps in these degraded urban environments that we are increasingly creating across the planet, where there is sort of, you know, quite ephemeral, varied, scrappy bits of flowers here and there, wasps might actually be really important backup pollinators in these regions where perhaps the floral diversity or richness is not good enough to support good populations of bees. So there is this idea, I mean, it's just an idea, it hasn't been tested, by these researchers that suggest that wasps could be really important backup pollinators. So that is one reason to value them. Yeah, that's a lot to say about pollination, sorry.
No, it's all fascinating. There was one thing about the figs that you were hoping to clear up as a misconception, that vegans cannot eat figs. Can you talk about the final part of what the fig actually does with the wasp that's died inside it?
Yeah, that's right. So people think, oh my goodness, I can't eat a fig. I'm a vegan. I'll be eating wasps. I can't do that. Or they just don't like the idea of eating a fruit that might have loads of dead bodies of, it's the males. You're eating the male wasps, aren't you? That's not true at all, because the fig produces an enzyme, phycin, which breaks down completely digests the wasp's body. So I guess you are sort of eating a wasp, because it's used, it must in some way get some kind of nutrient from that, some value of that, but it is, they're not eating wasps. So it's perfectly vegan friendly.
You've been to many places in the world and conducted various studies. Do you have another favorite wasp story from your own experiences that you'd like to share with listeners?
Well, I often get asked what my favorite wasp is. And actually, most people say, I bet you haven't got a favorite wasp. That's a very silly statement, because actually, of course I do. My favorite wasp is a paper wasp that lives in Central and South America. It's called Polistes canadensis. And it's about 2 centimeters long. It's chestnut colored. It has a whopping sting. but these are the, I guess, after having done my PhD on these rather delicate, you know, little fairy wasps, essentially, they had hardly any stings at all. I graduated onto these much larger, more fierce, real wasps, I like to call them, Polistes, and I studied them in Panama at the Smithsonian Institute. And I got my teeth even further into wasps when I started to study these things, because they live in these simple societies. I like to refer to them as like the insect version of a meerkat society. So everybody loves meerkats. We've all enjoyed David Attenborough's films on meerkats and how the individuals within these different groups have their roles. You've got the sentries and you've got the reproductives and you've got the nurses and the brood carers, not brood, the pup, the ones that look after the offspring. And actually these Polistes wasps are just like that. And Polistes is a genus that is cosmopolitan. You have lots of them, different species in the US, for example, and they have been studied. They've been models for studying for social evolution and social behavior for over 100 years. And in fact, I think probably it's fair to say that Polistes wasps are responsible for putting wasps on the research map for studying them for social evolution. And this goes back to this Italian researcher, Leo Pardi, in the early 1900s, who did some founding work on Polistes, European Polistes, Polistes dominula. But anyway, the wasp in Panama was so special to me because I studied it for many years and I was amazed that it kind of did the wrong thing. So most of our understanding of Polistes social behavior was based on the European Polistes species, the very common species, Polistes dominula, which is also an invasive species in the US, actually. And our understanding of how these individuals and the societies regulated their social hierarchies seemed to be quite straightforward. So all of the, just like a meerkat society, all the individuals in these societies have the potential to be reproductive. So unlike, you know, your honeybee workers or your vespula workers, these, all the wasps in these societies can mate, can develop their ovaries and lay eggs if the opportunity arises. But in temperate regions like Europe, for example, they don't normally, the workers, the sort of the brood that emerge as the first generation, don't normally get the chance to become a queen, become a reproductive, partly because there might not be males around, because they tend to produce males towards the end of the colony cycle, or they just don't have, there's no nesting sites available. And of course, there is the lure of rearing your own, helping rear relatives, which you passing on your genes by rearing relatives, which is our foundation of understanding and explaining the evolution of altruism and helping behavior. And so we had this idea from the from temperate Polistes, many species, that there is this kind of age-determined cue. So if the queen happens to die, there is only one queen at any one time. If she happens to die, it's normally the one of the oldest workers, one of the ones that's been around the most, which will very calmly step into her shoes and become the new queen. And that's kind of been the mantra about what regulates this sort of convention that regulates Polistes social groups and social hierarchies. But in these Panamanian species, which actually incidentally had been studied by my heroine, Mary Jo Mastaberhard, many years earlier, she mentioned in one of her thesis, actually, that there's been these huge fights. So if the queen disappears, the wasps have a huge fight. And this was just not what we expect based on what we understand about European Polistes. And so I started to study that a bit and I was trying to understand. I didn't really believe her, to be honest. I thought, oh, it's always an age-determined cue. How can she possibly possibly have got this wrong? I think she must have aggravated them. Anyway, I did the experiment. So I removed the queens, lots of nests, high sample sizes. And lo and behold, they did exactly what Mary Jane said they would. They had these almighty fights. And it was often one of the younger ones that would become the new queen. And in fact, I did these experiments where I removed all the wasps except for an old worker and or a young worker. And I found that all the nests where we'd removed all the wasps except a young worker, the young worker would develop her ovaries, mate, and become take over that nest as the queen. And then the new brood would emerge as her workers. But on the nest where we left just an old worker, and by old, I mean like 30 days, that's quite old for a wasp, they didn't develop their ovaries and they either disappeared or joined another nest, which suggested to us that these older wasps are somehow not able to develop their ovaries. So it's almost like an insect menopause, if you like, although obviously not menopause, but there is something limiting their ability to activate their reproductive system that may be to do with age, or it could be to do with the early life experiences, the kind of stressful life that they might have had as a forager. So there was lots of cool stuff going on. And then, so this is why they're my favourite wasp. And the other reason why they're my favourite wasp is because we sequenced their genome back in 2015, and it was the first hunting wasp genome to be sequenced. There'd already been a parasitoid wasp genome, Nasonia, but this was the first hunting wasp genome to be sequenced. I was quite proud of that.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that 30 days old is very old for a wasp. And you talked to us in the book about how there is already a documented loss of insects in the world and that we don't know enough about wasps. So we don't know how many species of wasp that we've lost, but we do know with what's going on with the environment, we are shortening sometimes the lifespans of the insects that have survived. And when you have only a 30-day lifespan, there's no days or hours to shorten without having an effect. What are your concerns about wasp habitat loss and loss of species?
So I think the age thing is a bit of a misnomer, actually, because don't forget these are social wasps. So the reason that they only live for 30 days is because they're foraging, and foraging is really risky. And so they get eaten by predators or they get lost in rainstorms. So it's not something to do with human activity, though it could be spotted by humans, but their survivorship is low because they have a very risky life. If they just stay on the nest, they can actually live for about a year. We've published a paper where we kept them in the lab and we called it, and they lived for over a year and they just wouldn't die. And so we called the paper Long Live the Wasp. But anyway, I digress. So the wasp populations around the world. Yes, we have very little data. And I think that's a nice thing to draw back to, actually, the stark contrast with bees. And there have been a large number of really excellent studies in the last just 2 or 3 years looking at the bee populations around the world and showing which species are declining and which species are not, because it's not everything that's declining. It's just, you know, there are winners and losers in this Anthropocene, this altered environment we're creating. But nonetheless, something to be very concerned about in the abundance of these species. So the reason that we have really good data on bees is because people love to record bees. And particularly in the UK, we have the Biological Record Centre, which collates all of the data that amateur naturalists will submit to their records. Used to be on, you know, slips of paper that they'd post off in the olden days. They've been doing this for over 40 years. But today it's all online. And through things like iRecord or iNaturalist, people upload their records of I saw species X in place Y on this date. And all that data goes into these large databases. And then scientists can use those data sets to look at insect population trends. And with, in many cases, we have data going back over 40 years or so. So you can really see, you can start to see these trends. And there are indeed very concerning trends there. But oddly, or maybe not oddly, I rest my case really, that wasps are largely not recorded, particularly social wasps, things like the Vespula yellow jackets and things like that, because people will see a wasp, but they won't think it's important enough to record it. They don't, you know, they'll see a lovely bumblebee, they'll stick it into iRecord or iNaturalist, but they won't do that for a Vespula. I like to call it wasp blindness. I think we don't want to see them, and so we don't think it's important enough to record. As a result, the data on wasps are very poor. But there is a study that actually I was involved with a year or so ago, where we looked at the biological records data. So these data submitted by amateur naturalists, who incidentally are the most amazing insect IDs in the universe, and I bow to their superior skills, they're amazing. But we also used museum collections from the Natural History Museum in London. And by looking at the species and modelling their diversity and distributions, looking at their populations using occupancy modelling, we were able to look at how their populations had changed over the last 100 years, actually, because this museum data took us back 100 years. And what we found was that actually the Vespula populations, so these yellow jackets, are actually doing fine, at least in the UK. Their populations don't seem to be changing too much. And that kind of fits with what we observe and actually what we know about these insects, that they're very good at adapting. They're very good at establishing themselves in novel environments. They are a highly invasive insect, alien species in non-native areas. So, for example, Vespula wasps have been introduced from the UK to New Zealand and Australia, and they are incredibly successful there to the level that they are causing ecological damage. So wasps in the wrong place are definitely a bad thing. But then the same could be said for any invasive species, really. So these Vespula wasps seem to be very robust. And they're very adaptive. They nest in we are destroying habitats they would naturally nest in, because they would choose to nest in a rodent burrow or something. But we're also creating habitats for them, because they love nesting in our sheds and our lofts. So the Vespula wasps are doing really well. And the hornets are actually doing quite well as well, at least until the last 10 or 20 years. In fact, their populations have increased quite a lot since the 1970s. And that's probably a sign of a warming environment. So this is all based on British populations, but the European hornet, Vespa crabrow, used to be only limited to the southern parts of the UK. But over the last 40 years, they have started to move northwards, and therefore their ranges are expanding and they are increasing in the UK. And that, of course, is a product of our effect on the environment, these warming of the environment. But in the last couple of decades, actually, we've seen a slowing of that. And what we think may be happening there is that although we are improving the environment for hornets by making it warmer so they can expand their ranges, we are at the same time destroying the habitats that they need. So hornets will rarely nest in your house or your shed. They like to nest in rotting trees. And so the more we destroy our ancient woodlands, the less habitat there will be for hornets. And maybe some of your listeners are thinking, well, that's not a bad thing, especially if you're in the States and you knew the stories about the giant Asian hornet, Vespa mandarinia. You might be thinking, well, we don't need any more hornets. But actually, it's important to remember that hornets are really important in natural ecosystems. So in their native environments, they're really important as top predators. And they should be valued along with all of the other insects in the environment. And hornets are really beautiful, and they're actually much less likely to bother you at a picnic. I bet no one's been bothered by a hornet at a picnic recently, whereas they have been by a Vespula wasp.
We're starting to run out of time, so I want to ask you, The book takes us through quite a lot of changes in wasp anatomy as they go through evolution over billions of years and how long they've been around. And it strikes me in reading the book that you have quite a strong love of the wasp, of their beauty, of all things about them. Is there a particular part of their anatomy or an adaptation of their anatomy that fascinates you that you'd like to share with listeners in the few minutes that we have left?
Well, I think across the whole spectrum of the wasps, and if we stand back and we take the big view of wasps, which includes the parasitoids, it includes the solitary hunting wasps, it includes the social wasps, but it also includes the original wasp, which was actually a vegetarian. It was a sawfly or a horntail or a wood wasp. I think if you look across this enormous, phenomenal tree of life, and of course, if you remember that bees are just wasps that have forgotten how to hunt because they evolved from wasps, and ants are just wasps that have forgotten how to fly, except for the sexuals, because they evolved from wasps, then everything is a wasp, right? These are all wasps. And within this tree of wasp life, we have all these incredible innovations. Innovations in terms of changes in their diet. So they switch from the sawflies, which would lay their eggs in plant, which still do, the extant forms lay their eggs in plants, when the eggs will hatch and the larva will eat the plant. And then there is the innovation of switching to eat, to laying your eggs on a caterpillar or a beetle larva. So that's the transition to carnivory. At the same time, you've got the innovation of the wasp waist. So sawflies are quite dumpy. They don't have this kind of slender waist at all. They only evolved when parasitoid wasps evolved. And we think that the importance of the wasp waist is that it enabled the abdomen to reach around in much more intricate places so that they could get their ovipositor into places that they couldn't previously have got. So it gives them much more maneuverability. And then there's the innovation where the ovipositor evolves into a sting. And then along with that came the hunting wasps and the innovations with how their venom developed and the cocktails of the venom, which we haven't discussed much, but you know, it's another, I like to describe it as an untapped medicine cabinet. There are so many things waiting to be discovered and exploited within venom of wasps. And then we've got sociality, which is incredible. There are over 1,500 species of social wasps, and they display this whole spectrum of sociality, going from these kind of simple societies and those meerkat insect type societies through to the Vespula and the hornets, which are, I refer to them as the honeybee of the wasp world. They're just as complex and phenomenal as the honeybee. So all the social behaviours that the honeybees have, these wasps have that too. So I can't pinpoint one. There are so many amazing innovations. I've spent most of my career obsessing about sociality, but to be honest, by writing this book, I've learned so much about the non-social wasps and the parasitoid wasps and the sawflies that I think I need several lifetimes to study it all.
Thank you so much for being here today, Professor Sumner, and telling us about the secret world of wasps. I wish we had time to get into venom and all the things we didn't cover, but I trust that listeners will get a copy of the book and they will learn even more. This has been The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.